Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marie Noah Ngoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. All right, joining me today is one of the biggest gifts to the African continent, a man with a drive that no other can match. Joining me today is Dr. Colonel Kefefe Kizza-Besigye, a living legend from Uganda. I think I can retire my podcasting efforts after this conversation because what? Anyway, we had such a delightful, honest, and human conversation, if I'm to be honest. And so I'll be breaking this up into two parts. All right, so Dr. Kizza-Besigye is a Ugandan physician, politician, and former military officer in the Uganda People's Defense Force. He served as the president of the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC, and is a long-time opposition leader in Uganda. I believe he's run for presidency about four times. Now, the disarming thing about Dr. Kizza-Besigye is his warmth and smile. If someone told you his story and told you to point him out in a lineup of people, I don't think you'd be able to do it. He does not look like what he's been through, what he's lived through. And the reason for that he shares in this episode. So, without further ado, join me in part one of my chat with Dr. Kizza-Besigye. So, Dr. Kizza-Besigye, thank you so much for joining me on the Brentas Foundation podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. I wanted to start here. So, reflecting on your sort of remarkable journey in Ugandan politics, you know, what pivotal moments or experiences would you say like shaped your perspective and approach to leadership? And how did they sort of influence your commitments to advancing democracy and human rights in Uganda?
It's a rather broad span of my involvement in politics in our country. I didn't set out to be in politics. I set out to be a medical worker. But the politics of our country did not allow me to pursue my career because we've had instability right from independence. No leader in my country, Uganda, has ever handed over power to another. The independence leader overthrew was the prime minister. We had a parliamentary system at independence, and there was a constitutional head of state who was the president and was also the king of Buganda, one of the kingdoms that formed the country Uganda. And the prime minister overthrew the president only 2 years after independence using the military, and the president had to flee into exile. And later, the military that he used to overthrow this king overthrew him in 1971. And that was Idi Amin. And Idi Amin ruled until 1979. When, with the help of the Tanzanian forces, some Ugandan militants then overthrew Idi Amin. And it has been on like that. I was at some stage in a restaurant and attacked by these military people, wow, totally without any provocation, simply because I had greeted a former schoolmate of mine, a girl whom they seemed to have had a relationship with or something like that. And, you know, I was badly beaten in the middle of a restaurant having dinner. And that really turned my mind to question whether this is a country in which I am a citizen and have rights. And so when Idi Amin was overthrown, I took more interest in politics. And that's how I supported a young party that was beginning then, trying to put up a different platform from the independence parties. So we still had the independence parties, the ruling independence party, and the one which was in opposition at independence, and mm-hmm. which had rather polarized along religious lines. And I thought that this was polluting the politics and not allowing free choices of people based on rational consideration of the political programs that these parties were espousing. And so we wanted to support a new platform that was focused on the real governance issues, that was non-denominational, without the influences of denominations as were the independence parties.
Yeah.
And the leader of that new formation then turned out to be the current president of Uganda, Yoweri Museveni, then a young man in his late 30s. And we went through an election in 1980. I was active now in supporting that candidate and the other candidates of that political platform. And it was a very violent election even then. And it was never allowed to go to its logical conclusion. After the polling, the head of the transitional government, which was a military council, announced that he had dismissed the electoral commission that had organized that election and taken over all the powers of the electoral commission and went ahead to announce whatever he wanted, regardless of what had transpired in the elections. And that, of course, caused a lot of discontent, and it was the discontent that resulted in a bush war, in some kind of a guerrilla war beginning, led by Yoweri Museveni. And at that time, I had qualified from college, and I was at our main hospital doing my internship, actually. And then I was detained and nearly killed. I had no knowledge about what had happened with those who went to the bush. I had no interest even in the bush matters. I think someone thought that maybe I had. And for that reason, yes, I was grabbed from a hotel lobby where I had gone to visit someone and incarcerated in terrible conditions and tortured very badly. And the many people we were with in those dungeons have never been seen again. I was lucky, helped by a Tanzanian military officer who had also brought some prisoners there whom I had helped at the hospital, who recognized me and eventually influenced my release. And then I fled into exile. And that's how, from exile, I made up my mind to go and join the fighting in the bush. And so I came back from Kenya, where I was working in the hospitals there, and joined the bush war. And that is how I got entangled in the politics. So from the bush, which lasted 5 years, by the grace of God again, we won the war and took over government in 1986. And I was appointed into government as a minister. I was a young man then. I was still a very young man. In fact, when I was sworn in as a minister, I was not yet 30 years. And I served, so we had thought we would have a transitional period of 4 years within which we would reorganize the state and usher it back into a democratic dispensation with having free and fair elections at the end of that transitional period. As it turned out, our leader had totally different plans, and that's how he's still in power nearly 40 years later. and so when I started seeing the trends moving in a direction that I didn't bargain for, I protested, and out of my protests, I was thrown out of government. I was still... I was still, of course, conscripted in the military formation that had come out of the bush, because all of us who had been in the fighting had been now turned into a regular force of the government. We had become the National Army, and we had been given formal ranks. So although I was serving in government as a minister, I was still a member of the armed forces, and it proved quite a tough process being released from the military, because then it served the president, knowing that I didn't quite agree with what he was doing. He didn't want to release me from the military. The military became a convenient kind of holding ground, because then you are. Constrained by military discipline and military law, and your freedom of citizen is constrained. And so it took a big fight actually to get out of the military. Eventually, I was nearly court-martialed. In fact, a court-martial had been set up to court-martial me for having made statements that became public that were critical of the government, and that I shouldn't have done that while still a serving officer of the military. And then it became very political. It was questioned widely by the country, why is this persecution. And eventually, anyhow, I was released from the military in the year 2000. And then shortly thereafter, it's a long story than I am putting it now, I offered myself to contest against President Museveni in the elections that were in 2001. And that election became very, very violent. Many people were killed, maimed, eventually, we petitioned the Supreme Court challenging the outcome of that election. It was a very interesting petition. The Supreme Court that had the petition eventually was divided. So in a majority, the election was upheld. The situation on my side remained very precarious. I had to flee the country later on that year and lived in South Africa for 4 years in exile, but decided to come back in 2005, just ahead of the 2006 elections. And it eventually nearly proved fatal, because I was arrested shortly after my return and charged with terrorism, with treason, with rape, with the illegal possession of guns, however, the political struggle intensified. I was eventually, against the will of government, nominated from prison. Eventually got bail some weeks to the election, it was again a very highly rigged election. We petitioned against it again in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was once again divided. This time there was a quorum of 7. It divided into 4-3, the majority again upholding the election. And the struggle has continued since. Up to now, I have, of course, since contested, I contested more 2 times, the last one being in 2016. My story is largely a story of a failed transition in our country. Transition from military control to popular sovereignty, to popular democracy. Because you see, since independence, first of all, the colonial rule, its effect was to create an artificial state, as it did in all parts of Africa, that divided our natural states, our natural, the natural nations that we had, the kingdoms I was talking about, which had naturally evolved and formed within within our region. These were artificially divided by lines drawn in Berlin. And so you had sometimes families being divided into 2 countries and communities obviously divided into 2 countries and so on.
Yeah.
And then the territory that is now Uganda ruled by the British. And there was agitation obviously for independence, which led eventually combined with, I think, multiple other agitations around the British Empire, led to independence in 62. But independence did not lead to a transition from control of power by the Queen of England, which was controlled by a force outside the population. The power was passed on to the political elites, not to the people, really. And so the contestation has been for power amongst the elites, using force all this time, and not the population. So the power has never gone to the population, really. Since independence, that transition is the awaited transition from a control of power by a political cabal or to the people. That's why the citizens, or if we actually don't qualify to be called citizens, because citizens presupposes that they have rights, citizen rights. In this case, the most cardinal right is the political right to determine how you are governed and who governs you, which our people have never done. No, as I have told you, no leader has ever been removed by the people, and no leader has ever been brought by the people. All leaders are brought by guns and taken away by guns. So people don't have power to determine how they are governed or how who governs them. And that is the failed transition that eventually sucked me into the struggles for popular sovereignty. And it is the struggle that I am still passionately engaged with. So my involvement in politics is not to seek really political leadership on my part, to become a president, to espouse a political ideology that will transform the country and so on and so forth. I'm interested in that, obviously, but that is not available until there is a policy allows contestation of ideas and the determination of which idea governs made by the population. That is what is not there. And that is my primary concern and involvement in the political arena. It is to fight for a transition that would engender popular sovereignty. If that is achieved, then frankly, my interest, as I have pointed out right from childhood, has never been in politics to become, you know, a political actor and get involved in the actual transformation activities and so on. I would obviously continue to have interest, but not to offer leadership in that regard.
I could listen to you all day. Not particularly because it's great stuff, but it's like your story, Dr. Besigye, is just one of those ones that sometimes you're like, yeah, I think I have problems, but you know, actually probably don't have problems. You are dealing with the hard stuff. You, every single day, the choices you make and don't make, it's in the face of very tough conditions, and it's very inspiring to hear. It's unfortunate to hear that that is the case, but it's also very inspiring, and I'll come to one of the reasons why. But I just wanted to ask Dr. Besigye, how many times have you been arrested?
Frankly, can't count.
Goodness. Goodness.
But definitely in the hundreds.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, because there are times when I would be arrested almost 4 or 5 times a week and not taken to court, but arrested because they didn't want me to get into, they thought if I went into the public, it would inspire the public to protest and to, so they called it preventive arrest. So as soon as I stepped out of my home, I would be grabbed and taken to a police cell way out of Kampala, well out of the capital city, kept there until in the middle of the night, maybe around 1 or 2 a.m., then driven and thrown back into my home. And I would continue doing that until eventually they now decided to barricade me at home. So they erected actually a barracks at my home and...
Really?
Yes, and put a whole ring of... soldiers and erected the barracks, brought mobile toilets for the soldiers and so on.
Wow.
That's why I didn't get out of home for months.
And I can really imagine. So I had the privilege, I can call it, of reading one of the books by Pakwenza. Some of the things detailed in that book, I'm like, I cannot imagine for somebody like you, the number of times that you have gone in, you've been incarcerated and tortured, it's slightly frightening to even try to conceptualize. And that's just from reading one person's account of being in what I think 3 or 2 times or so. So I can't even begin to imagine the things you've had to live through and the stories you have. I'm sure that would be a whole other episode, or maybe your book we can read through as well. But it's incredible to think about. Another question I have is, so when you sort of decided to join the Bush War and the leadership came out of current President Museveni, was the man you see now, is he different from the man you met then, or was he just the same, but everybody was caught up in sort of the collective struggle against what at the time seemed worst alternative, if I can call it that?
Yeah, well, the person that Museveni is now is definitely way, way different from Museveni I joined in 1980. Different in every sense. Different, you know, physically, of course, he's grown much older and is now rather frail. But more importantly, different in what he says now and does, totally different from what he said then and did. In fact, radically different. However, so it's a bit of a puzzle, because whereas what he says and does now are radically different from what he said and did then, really is the same man. In other words, he did not change. He was and remains an excellent actor. So he can create impressions that that are very, very persuasive of what he is not. And I think that has been in a large measure a part of how he has succeeded to do what he has done for as long as he has done it. Because even today, I meet many people who are really not quite, you know, in terms with the real Museveni that, that is there, who still consider that he is a different person from the one that is acting, and they attribute, so they, you find people attributing the terrible things he does to people around him. And they say, no, they, you know, Museveni is, because actually even today, if you meet him one-on-one, he will put on a show that cannot be in any way related with what he does before he met you, what he's going to do after he has met you. So he's he has an incredible capacity to deceive and to act. But I, having, you know, I was among the very, very first people, I think, within our group of the Bush War activists to really understand what we were dealing with. Because again, I had the unique opportunity to work and live very closely with him. First of all, during the whole of the Bush War, I was acting as his medical doctor, and for which reason we stayed together closely throughout the Bush War. And after the Bush War, amongst the other things, I served as a minister in his office. So I had a unique opportunity from my other colleagues of being close to him, and therefore being also increasingly free and open with him, and so it was easy for me earlier on, more than the others, to realize that the person I thought I was dealing with was actually fake.
This is not what you signed up for.
Absolutely. And it traumatized me. It traumatized me, actually.
I can only imagine.
Yes, when I realized that all along, because I revered him. I revered him. I respected him immensely. I, you know, trusted him and considered that, you know, he was a rare gift to the country and an icon. And then, increasingly, but there was a moment, there was a specific moment when I realized, when he was telling me lies of things that I was very, very aware of, and he was telling me, you know, complete lies because I had called him out and said, what about this? What about this? And then he started telling me blatant lies in my face. And then I realized, and we were talking about corruption actually at that stage in those conversations. And then it dawned on me that, the corruption we are talking about is right in front of me. And I have always been mistaken to think that this was a different man. And it was traumatic. It was traumatic to me, you know. And indeed, I think he realized immediately the great disappointment that realization had on me. And I think for a good measure, he immediately dismissed me from government.
I can imagine.
That was the beginning of this.
As someone who's experienced, you know, firsthand the challenges of opposing an entrenched regime, what valuable lessons would you say you've learned along the way? And what advice would you offer to sort of emerging opposition leaders facing similar struggles in their own countries, especially in Africa?
Well, first of all, where I came from to become a part of this struggle, I think was helpful to me in terms of preparation for what I have encountered. And I guess we come into these kind of situations from different backgrounds. But before I left the hospital in Nairobi to head for the bush, it was a very, very difficult and fundamental decision to be made at that point in my life. I had no family, was not married or had, whereas I had no family of my own, I had responsibilities because our parents had passed away when I was young, both my mom and dad, and I had taken over more or less the leadership of the family at a very young age. So I would at some stage take my little sisters to school and then also go to my own school. And so I had this burden of responsibility now that I was out of school. And so making a decision to now go to the bush to fight a government, a decision you knew had huge implications of whether you ever get out of that bush alive or what, you know, was not an easy decision to make.
Right.
And I, grappled with it for quite a while. But the process of grappling, of, you know, trying to internalize that and turn it around and come to grips with what it meant and what it would take prepared me in a unique way, I believe, that I have benefited from, because I decided, you know, if my life ends here, so be it. Let it end at least while I'm doing something that can have a profound benefit for many in my country, so that they don't have to go through what I had just gone through. And if I am luckier, that then I can live in a country that I'm proud to call mine. And so I prepared myself psychologically for the worst and for a long haul, because I didn't know how long it would take to get out of that kind of a situation. And so that psychological preparation for any situation has been extremely helpful in dealing with all the multitude of challenges that I have confronted, both in the bush, which were immense and the subject of a whole book, and more recently in government and in opposition of government, and in all these trying situations. So psychological preparation, I think, is key for anybody who wants to challenge dictatorships like the African dictatorships, especially if they are as entrenched and violent as the ones that we have been dealing with here. Psychological preparation is key. Secondly is ideological commitment. You must have, I think, a focus, a strong focus on what it is you want to achieve, and the commitment to it, you know, to say, like I have told you, first of all, my really pull into this was human rights, you know, simply the blatant violation of my rights and the rights of very many whom, as I have told you, many never made it, whom we were with in prison. You know, that simple, the basic right of a person to life, that, you know, you have a right to life, you have freedom to talk, to move, to express yourself, to work in concert with others and organize, and, you know, those basic rights. I then became very, very strongly aware of their importance and attached to their pursuit. So, and that focus is critical, because there are many moments when one more or less feels like not getting out of bed, when there have been a lot of disappointments, when there have been simply too many challenges cropping up at the same time, almost appearing insurmountable, and the attraction to say, is it worthwhile to continue with this, doing what I'm doing? Or should I just take a break? Should I just leave? Should I, you know, like I told you, I was in exile, and to some extent, you know, at the beginning of when we were chatting before this program, we were talking about this colleague who, the lady, the Swazi lady who has gone back.
Tanele Mufuko.
Yes, and going back to a place where you know there is danger. That attraction, that pull, you know, I experienced it. I had run away into South Africa, which was fairly free. Of course, not entirely safe, because even there I was pursued and nearly killed there. But safer, and maybe I could even get to farther away places, more farther away places, and so on. But then, you know, you think about where you leave this monstrous situation that the country is encumbered with, that indeed nearly ended your own life, has ended the lives of so many trying to change it. You know, like the war I was telling you about in the Bush War killed around 500,000 people. And there are monuments erected in those fighting areas of where scars were gathered and the other body, you know, remains of people that died because of that war. And you know, so some of these people, of course, who died were just victims of, the situation. They were not even political. But the colleagues with whom we set out to say, let's change this, and who have died along the way, then become a burden on your conscience because they died hoping for a different situation in their country. They offered their ultimate sacrifice for it. So you who is alive becomes your task, your duty to not let their death or their own sacrifices to be in vain. So the focus on the mission, what is your mission, what is your strategic goal in whatever you are doing, the focus and commitment on it is extremely important. And I've seen many colleagues who have given up simply because I think their passion, their commitment, their ideological understanding of the dynamics of our struggle is a little low. So that is, I think, the second thing that I would point out as critical. And of course, no fighting or struggling, political struggles are team matters that you cannot do as a person. You have to do them as a group. They are group activities. They are social and activities, social political activities, and so the energy that is in the collective is quite important. It energizes, the collective energy of those in the struggle. If the morale, the collective aspirations become quite important. If you are left on your own, and indeed the moments when one is isolated in prisons or even when you are like in exile are moments that could easily tip one into depression.
I can imagine.
So one needs that collective energy and the interactions of colleagues in the struggle.
Okay, that's the end of part one of my chat with Dr. Kizza Besigye. It's a tough world we live in, and there are some amongst us like Kizza who have dedicated their lives to causes bigger than themselves and their families. Talk about a life of service. Join us next week for part two of my chat with Kiza. If you think your mind is blown, you haven't heard nothing yet. There's more he has to offer. He shares with us words of encouragement for those of us coming up behind him who want to create a much better world than that which we've come to meet for ourselves, for our families, and for the continent at large. But before you go, can I ask for a favor? Please share this episode within your network, with your friends, with your families. There's power in the truth being known, and stories like this go far and wide. So please do that for me. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Marie Noel Mokolo. And until next week, do stay well. Thank you. Bye-bye.